The last few weeks we've been going over verses 11 and 12, and I just want to read that real quick here before we get into 13 and 14. It says, "Do this, knowing the time, that is already the hour for you to awaken from sleep. For now salvation is nearer to us than when we believed. The night is almost gone, the day is near. Therefore let us lay aside the deeds of darkness and put on the armor of light. Let us behave properly as in the day, not in carousing and drunkenness, not in sexual promiscuity and sensuality, not in strife and jealousy, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh in regard to its lust." Now, I like going through verse by verse, because what that forces you to do when you do it is it forces you to go through verses that you typically wouldn't necessarily go through. And so when I get to those verses, I have a choice. Do I just hit on it briefly? And sometimes I do. You know, I try to use wisdom as much as possible on how to do these things. Or do I go ahead and dive in a little bit deeper? So I always like to look at, especially in the New Testament, I always like to look at the languages and find out if there's anything interesting in the Greek, or, you know, in the grammar, or in the actual syntax and the definition of the words. I'm sorry, lexicology and the definitions of the words. And so normally, I wouldn't actually hit on a lot of verse 13. I would just talk about, it's like, hey, we all know what that stuff's talking about. However, when I got into the definitions of the words, one of the things that I found is that the English words did not do the Greek words justice. So I thought, and there's actually a flow and a theme of why he's mentioning these specific words here that I wanted to go ahead and go into. Okay, now we're going to spend a couple of weeks, few weeks possibly, on this, because I think it's pretty important. And then, you know, we'll dive into chapter 14 when we get there. So Paul, you know, he's continuing his preparation for the saints in Rome. Now, remember, and this is important for what we're going through, remember what Rome was. Rome was an immoral, idol-filled center of a republic that had abandoned its founding principles and embraced an empire run by incestuous, murderous, lustful, power-hungry despots. It's a glowing description, right? That's really what it was. That's really what it was. I mean, other than that, it was fine. I'm sure it was a great place to vacation. You know, this is interesting. What do those despots and the Apostle Paul have in common? Because they have something in common. What do the despots that ran Rome and the Apostle Paul have in common? They both needed peace for them to get what they wanted. The despots needed peace to get taxes, because if you have rebellion in the empire, tax money doesn't flow. And if there's one thing that we know that they need new palaces. They have to have new palaces. So I need peace for the tax money to flow. Now, Paul, no peace, if he didn't have peace, he wasn't going to be able to travel the way that he did in his missionary journeys to preach the gospel. Now, he would get into places where peace would quickly fade away, and sometimes those folks would hunt him down in other locations where he would find himself, but he was at least was able to travel peacefully without the Roman authorities getting on his case. Right? Yeah. That worked out most of the time. But you see, even though they had something in common, Rome was on a collision course with Christianity that was begun by Judaism decades earlier. So we know that Judaism was at odds with Christianity almost right from the get-go. They had a little bit of peace, but then, man, it just blew up. Rome was on that same collision course, but for different reasons. Ultimately, the systems are incompatible. See, that I love seeing the inconsistent groups that have nothing in common binding together for common purposes. Gays for Palestine. It's like, okay, ship some of those guys over to Hamas and see what they do with them. You know, really, the only reason they they mesh at the moment is because they're both Marxist groups. So Marxism, I guess, trumps all. Again, unless it's Hamas, and then, you know, the way that they like to do it is they hold them upside down by the ankles on a tall building and let them drop. But hey, gays for Palestine, whatever floats your boat, I guess, right? Paul here is preparing the saints for that violent collision which was going to take place in 6 years. The catalyst, the burning of Rome. Nero decides he needs someone to blame this on, so he blames the Christians. And there the collision took place. They still have 6 years, so Paul is in the process of warning them and helping them become the kind of people that they need to be to withstand that. Now, I don't know if Paul had an inkling as to what was going to happen. Sometimes people think that apostles, you know, they're like these all-knowing people. No, they know what God gives them. And God might not have given Paul this little piece of information, but this piece of information, even though he might not have had it, what he was writing was vital for them at the time so that they could be prepared for it. So God knew. Instructing through the Apostle Paul to help them get prepared. Now, let's think about this from our perspective. He is preparing us now while we still have peace and prosperity. Now, if you missed Joel's message on Wednesday, I'm going to put it on the website this week. It was excellent. And his message this week was all about that, how sometimes people look at the peace and prosperity time and they think, well, you know, that's not really the time when growth takes place. Growth really takes place when you're struggling. Right, when hard times happen. And he brought it out very eloquently that the times of peace are the times where we can truly grow as well. In other words, there's no time when the Christian can't grow. And what we need to take advantage of are those times of peace so that we can grow. And he used a passage in Jeremiah, I believe it's in, what chapter was that?
12, verse 5,
where he talks about if you've run with the footmen and are tired, how are you going to run with the horses? Right, and that's a really good point that God's telling Jeremiah. Jeremiah is whining. Now, I use that term loosely because I think a lot of us would have whined too with what he was going through. But he's like, you haven't even, basically what God's saying is I know what's coming and you haven't even begun to face what you're about to face. If you're whining now, what happens when it really gets bad? Now for us, that could be 100 years from now. We might turn things around a little bit. We might continue going the way that we're going, and everything's going to be just fine. So let's say that's the case. Should we still be growing? Yes. And if it's not, should we still be growing while we have the opportunity in peace? Yes. That's what this time is for. So what is Paul saying? So I'm breaking this section down into three areas. He says in verse 13, let us behave properly as in the day, not in carousing, drunkenness, and sexual promiscuity, and sensuality, not in strife and jealousy, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh in regards to its lust. My three points are, we need to walk decently, we need to clothe ourselves with Christ, and we need to make no provision for the lust of the flesh. We will get through one of those today, because that was all my introduction. First one, walk decently. Walk decently. Now, he says, let us behave properly as in the day. Now, that's New American Standard. Maybe some of y'all's versions have walk in there. ESV? Okay. Yeah, ESV has walk. That's the actual word. Okay. And now, and also mine says properly in the New American Standard, but literally that word means decently. Now, a lot of these terms are pretty subjective, right? When you think of the word decent, man, how one person describes that and defines that could be very different from the way that another person defines it, right? What some people think is decent, others might think is indecent, and vice versa. Now, Paul uses a very specific word here. And what it means is having good form. Having good form. Now, again, that's subjective, isn't it? What does it mean to have good form? You know, I used to play a lot of baseball when I was a kid. And does the name Ted Williams ring a bell for anybody? Okay, I knew it would for Dale. Nobody else? Now, Ted Williams played for the Boston Red Sox. He's dead, but his head is frozen, you know, so that he could be revived at some later point in time when they're able to, you know, cure death and do that sort of thing. But Ted Williams was a right-hander, and you know I don't use sports analogies very much. Okay, Ted Williams was a right-hander, but he batted lefty. And he actually had a book that he wrote on how to properly have good form and do this. So I'm a right-hander, but my dad taught me to bat lefty. So if I play baseball, I bat left-handed. I don't even know how to swing right-handed. He didn't even teach me to be a switch hitter. You know, bat right-handed and left-handed. He taught me to bat lefty. So if I play golf, which I did for a little while, I used left-handed clubs and I swung left-handed. There was a very specific form that Ted Williams used. He had his elbows a certain way. He had his right arm a certain way. He had his hips a certain way. And he would do this little thing with his knee that he would cock it in a little bit in order to get the hips swinging around so that he would generate a lot of power. So my dad was a baseball coach, and so he taught me how to bat that way. And so I can still do the swing exactly the way I was taught, because it was beat into my head for years that I played. Now, if I would try to do something fancy, like what these guys do today, where they swing and then they let go of the bat, you know, to look all, it's a bad form. Bad form. Right form. Decent form. Good form. Use it. So, you know, you would use good form. But that's the thing. I started playing for somebody else. They tried to tweak my swing. That's not good form. Here's better form. That's what that word decent means. In other words, it's subjective. Everyone's going to have a different view. So God knows that. And so what's interesting is that this word is exclusively defined by context. Good form compared to what? In other words, the what that he's telling you to have good form about, the what is going to define what that form is and what's proper. So what's he say in verse 13? Let us behave properly as in the day. So there he's bridging the gap between verse 13 and what he was talking about in verses 11 and 12. In other words, he's talking about having good form as people of light. In other words, the light is going to determine what the form is supposed to look like. And this is the first place where things go off the rails for a lot of people. People talk so much in modern day Christianity, and this seeps into the church sometimes, I think, too, where there's so much of a focus on the individual that we forget about the group. If you look at the New Testament, there's a lot less focus on the individual versus the group. In other words, the individual, we do have an individual relationship with God. But a lot of times in the New Testament, that's couched in our relationship with each other and our relationship as a group to God. Notice the churches the churches that were written to in Revelation. He wrote to the whole group. He did talk about some who, if the church was bad, some were good. But the only people that he really singled out individually were the bad ones. Nah, he talked about Antipas, his faithful witness, but that guy was dead. So, you know, my point is that the individual walk that people say they have, sometimes they divorce it from the concept of what God expects from the whole of his church. And they say, you see, my walk's going to look different than yours. And that's true to a certain extent, isn't it? I mean, we're all individuals. But they forget that there's a form that they're supposed to walk after. So that while, yes, our walks look different because we're individual people, we have different strengths, we have different weaknesses, we have different personalities, we have different ways of doing things, we're all walking to be conformed to the same image. In other words, that doesn't change. The way we go about doing it might be a little bit different, but we're all going towards that same form. In other words, that word decent, having good form. What does it mean to walk decently? What's the form we're walking after? He says it's light, it's day. Well, 1 John 1:5, you don't have to turn there. This is the message which we have heard from him and announced to you, that God is light. And in him there is no darkness at all. What does that mean? What does it mean that there's no darkness in him? Well, we know what that means looking at the rest of the scriptures, don't we? There's no sin in him. He's 100% pure, unadulterated light. Completely pure, completely undefiled. As a matter of fact, Hebrews says he is pure and undefiled, and he's separated from sinners. See, Jesus, our high priest, didn't come to reconcile us to God in our present form as we stay in our present form. In other words, we're sinners, and he came to reconcile sinners to a holy God. And the only thing that he did is that he forgave us, but we're still ultimately always sinners and always going to be that way. And somehow we're supposed to just fellowship through the blood of Christ. No. That's woefully lacking in its completeness. Yes, God does take us in our present form as sinners, and he reconciles us to himself. But the proper theology in the scriptures is that he takes that old person and he kills them. And they are buried. And then they resurrect a new creature. That's how he does it. He doesn't take the old person and somehow try to make the blood of Christ the super glue that binds a sinner to the holy God. Where God just has, as we talked about first hour, he has total forgetfulness of our sins. But in this particular case, he just has selective amnesia. He just says, I know the sins are still there. I'm just not going to see them, okay? I know you're still rotten. You're still going to do all the same gross stuff you did before. And I know I've condemned other people for that, but I'm not going to condemn you for it because, you know, we got this great new super glue called the blood of Christ that you're now bound with me and I'm stuck with you forever. Nope. That's not how it works. We know that's not how it works. He's pure. And then flip with me to Ephesians 5. I know we've gone over this, but again, I think it's better to read this because, you know, you hear me say it, it's one thing, but we read it together. Please let this sink in, because Paul is really trying to take this passage and make it, he's making it powerful for us. He says, verse 6, let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. See, Let no one deceive you or me. Christ didn't save us so that we still do the same things and somehow that's okay. No, wrath comes upon the sons of disobedience. We can't still be sons and daughters of disobedience and expect to be saved because the super glue blood of Christ holds us together to God. No. He says in verse 7, therefore you, Christians, do not be partakers with them. For you were formerly darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light, for the fruit of the light consists of all goodness and righteousness and truth, trying to learn what's pleasing to the Lord. Look, God is light, and in Him there's no darkness at all. God is light, and in Him there's no darkness at all. Guess who else is light? Us. We are light. We are light. And what is that? So since we're light, what does our fruit look like? Well, goodness. Let me back up. All goodness, all righteousness, and all truth. That's what it looks like. So, it's decency is defined, the form is defined by light. But you know, the form is also defined by its prohibitions. And I'm not going to have time to go through these today. I just want to touch them briefly and we'll go over them next week. But you see, there's a list here in Romans 13. There's a list. Carousing, drunkenness, sexual promiscuity, sensuality, strife, and jealousy. Each of those words, well, most of those words, actually mean something a lot deeper than what the scriptures or than what the English is bringing out. See, so not only is it defined by the positives, it's defined by what's prohibited. I'm just going to hit these real quick. That word for carouse, you know, I'll just put it this way. The word for carousing, you know, you have carousing, drunkenness, sexual promiscuity, and sensuality. And then he separates strife and jealousy. The first four are all connected. They have to do with the physical consequences that typically associate intoxication. And that's important. You know, when I was growing up, in intoxication from all different types of forms, but specifically alcoholic intoxication here. When I was growing up, hanging out with people who did that, doing that too, people would either do one of two things. They'd either get really amorous or they'd get really angry. Either way, the judgment would typically be shut off. In these words that are here, if we were speaking Greek, you would immediately notice that these words bring out all of those aspects together. So in other words, Paul's trying to tell us something. And what he's telling us, we'll discuss next week. And we'll dive in. See, I don't like ending on negative stuff. So this actually works out pretty good. We'll end on the stuff on the light, and then we'll hit the other stuff next week, and then we'll end on being clothed with the Lord. You know, because I like ending on the positive stuff. I don't like ending on the negative stuff. But the point is, like I mentioned, the emphasis here is on light. That's the form. That's what we walk after. That's what we see. So if we want to know how we walk, we look at the character of God, We never judge our walk by what our neighbor is doing. We always judge our walk by what we see Jesus doing. And that's the form.